Welcome to the Big Muse Podcast. On our show today, we have, I would say, and I use the word judiciously, a bona fide musical genius. And for those of you who know him, you know I'm not using, you know, superlatives and just trying to be obsequious. He's truly is that. His name is Jeff Victor. Happens to be my cousin. We share my grandma and his grandpa were brother and sister, so we're closely related. He's one of my best friends in the entire world. We've toured all over the world together musically. We've been in 1,000 different projects. We've been on stage together thousands of times, literally. We read each other's mind. I think of Jeff as the old Russian guy that the two guys that sit on the bench in Santa Monica, that they're in a strange land and they love each other because they speak an identical language. And he is that person to me. For those of you who know him, you know what I'm talking about. Jeff Victor. Jeff, good to have you on the podcast.
Good to be here, cousin. I love that, by the way, when you put that on Facebook. Judy read it to me on my birthday. Totally brought
me. The old
me,
Russian thing?
Yeah, it brought me to tears.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. No, it is true.
I get it.
You know, as you get older, you kind of like the friends that you have that sort of instantly understand the context with which you, in which you speak, in which you live, and they just understand all the details, the history. It's such a rare thing.
So rare.
And it's such a, you know, it's such a huge blessing. It makes you feel like rooted in the world, like I'm not all alone. So I definitely have that with you.
You know, it could be due to a loss of testosterone over the years. You know what I mean? But because we get more tender, I guess you would say. You know what I mean?
We just become two big wieners, testosterone-less flailing wieners. Yeah. No, it's possible. The other thing is, as you live longer, you see people, you know, die, and you see people get sick. I mean, you become more aware. I don't know if it has anything to do with testosterone. It might.
I don't know. You know, speaking of hormones, I mean, you'll remember as well as I do, the thing that really bonded us when we were, what, we were like 15, and it was testosterone filled, because you'll remember, you know what I'm talking about, the skull. I had that anatomical skull that I had in my room. Remember that?
Yeah, I can't forget. Indelible memories. So you better explain, because this is to us normal stuff.
Oh,
and nobody knows. I had a girlfriend at 14. It was 14. It wasn't 15. And she summarily dumped me one day. And I was just, to say I was bereft was just a grave understatement. I literally was like suicidal for a day. And you and your great empathic moment, for some reason, took this prize anatomical skull that was like a model out of plastic that you'd made painstakingly over the course of a year.
Hours and hours.
You took it and you threw it and smashed it against your bedroom
smithereens.
Wall. Just like, I don't know. It's hard to understand the relationship for some people, but for me, it was just a show of, okay, you have pain. I'm gonna shoulder some of that pain. I'm gonna bear it by throwing this skull against the wall. It shattered into a million pieces, and really, that was the moment of true bonding.
Yeah, that was the proof. That was the proof, you know.
Yeah, and as depressed as I was, I'm sure I laughed my ass off, because that just the whole thing was so bizarre. And there have been thousands of episodes like that in our life. So
thousands.
So part of the thing that bonded us, I think, aside from not just because we're cousins, and there's a lot of cousins that people don't like, you never want to see them again,
exactly,
and that we're the same age, but that we had this interest, this burning interest in all things creative. Tell me, you know, what creativity means to you.
Wow. Creativity. Well, when I couple it with what you prefaced about our friendship, creativity means to me the mischief, the hijinks that you and I shared, turning into doing something that, like, making something. Okay, so the first thing we did was let's do a band. I mean, that was really our first big project, and I was almost like that movie Fight Club. You have an idea, there's no limits. You're an adolescent at that point. Let's see how far we can take this thing, you know. And to me, the creativity is mostly feeling alive and connected.
Yeah, I like that you said that. I mean, not only do I totally agree with it, but it you know, brings out a stronger point where people see people like ourselves who are involved in, quote, the arts and making music. And, you know, to me, those are secondary in a certain way. Those are what I'd call manifestations of this initial creative impulse, which is accessible to any human being. And as you say, it's a hallmark of aliveness that you have this idea, it springs to life in your mind and you desire to see it manifest itself, to play out, to grow to fruition somehow. That musters up in a person the desire then to learn the skills, to gain some mastery of skills, whatever skills are needed to bring whatever idea to life. In our case, it was music and art and, you know, really in conversation and lyrics. It was the desire itself that we chased.
Right.
That is at the heart of creativity. It's not the music. It's not the notes. It's not the chords. Mm-mm. It's not the scale. And people often get lost in that. They say, well, I don't have time to learn to play guitar. You know, it isn't that. I keep thinking, all you need to do is learn to have the desire, the burning desire, the unquenchable desire, and then you'll acquire the skills at any cost. Does that make any sense?
I totally agree. You know, I think of my Uncle Melvin, who would be like your, what, cousin Melvin. He was like a NASA engineer and brilliant guy. And he sat and listened to me play piano one day, and he says, and he's trying to pick it apart scientifically. And he's saying, Jeff, stop right there. Right there where you seem to play an extra little note. It was very faint, but the extra note you played, where is it written to do that? I go, Melvin, I'm not playing from written notes. I'm playing out of my head. He goes, what? Well, where do you get, where, what's telling you to, you know, play the next note, how soft, how loud? And of course, as a musician, you and I would say, well, like I think Louis Armstrong said to a person in the press who asked him a similar question, what is jazz? He said, if I got to explain it, you'll never know.
Well, I like that. And I would take a stab at explaining it for anyone listening. Because
if anyone,
you know,
can,
my
you
cousin
can,
and your uncle is a scientist, so he's going to be very analytical. And I would say a very close analogy would be a conversation. For example, the conversation that we're having right now, it's a complete improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we're using words that are pre-existing. You know, we're using the English language to support this improvisation. But the words themselves are very much like the way one would improvise on an instrument. It's not pre-planned.
Wow.
We're working based on the ideas that we have at the moment or the inspirations that we have at the moment. The words come out. And as I respond to your idea, that in my mind elicits this other sort of spark of something, and it becomes, if the improvisation between two people is really alive, the fundamental of it is listening. That's huge, and responding. So, you know, were I to have sat with which cousin was it? Was it the NASA guy?
That was Melvin.
Melvin, I would have just said, the same way that you have a conversation is the same way that we're improvising. One is the language of words and one is the language of notes. Now, the language of notes is not as common as the language of words, so you have to make that sort of mental leap. But I think the analogies and the metaphor is pretty clean.
Well, think of all the people who in conversation are like, old enough for you? You know, they just don't delve deep enough.
Yeah, yeah. We used to make fun. Like the worst question you can ever ask a teenager. What was that thing we used to do? Like, how's the basketball game? How's school? And the kid starts to answer and you go, what was that? You weren't ever listening.
Oh yeah. I don't want to say who was.
I guess that's an important idea too. Like, if you want to have a depthful conversation, don't ask questions that you don't care about the answer to.
Oh, for sure not that.
You know, that, well, they're that, not that, really seducing somebody to dig into their hearts and give up anything.
Well,
and that probably happens a lot in music, too. I mean, nobody's digging deep. There's not a way to respond to somebody that's kind of, you know, you can see they're just not invested. And part of it is, again, not the skills that we manifest, but the deep investment we have with life itself, trying to feel this alivement, this engagement, and those kinds of things, as opposed to what you just mentioned. Well, just cold enough for you out here. Like, what do you say to that? Yeah, Earl, it's certainly colder than it was yesterday.
Well, you know what? If my radar says that's all this guy wants and it's all he's capable of, I will wear that hat and I will play that. I go, oh yeah, well, it looks like we're getting a thunderstorm tomorrow. You know, I'll even change my accent just to fit in.
Yeah, do it 1 second. So how cold enough for you out here?
Oh yeah, well, I'm gonna try to stay indoors today.
Oh yeah, yep. I got a suit, snowmobile suit, and she's not even can't even keep me warm enough.
Oh jeez, I got a honeydew list a mile long, and a better half's asking me that I might as well stay inside.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna probably sit and possibly just watch the snow coming down. Then go get really poetical from here. Watch the snow coming down and. And then leave this boring conversation.
Then there's a moment of silence in which inserted in that silence is some profundity that they get a little uncomfortable with. And then I go, well, I suppose.
And then I'd say, well, you know, each snowflake is a thing of great beauty. It's been a long time since I've actually taken, and like I used to have as a child, a snowflake would fall on my glove. And I'd look at it, and I haven't told many people about this, but I would, in my solitude as a young boy, I would weep with awe at the textures, at the individual design of each snowflake, and weep with wonder at the creation of God to have created all these things that look similar on the surface, but in essence are so very different one from the other. It's so beautiful.
If someone like that did that, would that not be such a revelation? And there have
because
been...
every human being, though, feels that way about snowflake. They all did as a kid. None of us didn't feel that way. When we looked maybe through a magnifying glass or our eyes were so much better, you saw the first snowflake and you started to reflect. And this is for people who lived in northern climes as we did. We grew up in Minnesota. So
right.
Imagine if you're in Bimini, you had some grains of sand or something. But we marveled at the beauty of small things. At some point, we learned that small things weren't going to get us laid or feed us or make us famous or whatever it was. And we just sort of discarded those. But it is the providence of a child to have this sense of wonder about the world around them, which leads me into this other idea that if you're going to call yourself an artist, part of it is a search for the regaining of that same sense of wonder in a world that sort of prohibits or doesn't value that. There's no valuation, any quantitative valuation for things like the individuated beauty of snowflakes.
Right.
So
right.
The artist is saying, wait, 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 I know that's true. No one's, you know, making a lot of money on this. Nobody's aggrandizing themselves. But there is a profound, a more profound view of the world when you slow down and look at these things of beauty. And the artist's job is to direct people like right. that. Whether it was, you know, NWA or, you know, name any artist or Seurat or Picasso or anybody that was doing anything real. They were saying, wait a minute, what you see on the surface is not, certainly not the sum total. It's not the essence. It's not even real what's on the surface. Let me show you something that's more and more real.
Mm.
And I will have to say that in knowing you, and when I give you this emblem of artist, I don't mm-hmm. hand it out to everybody that's strumming a guitar or, mm-hmm. or drawing pictures or shooting photographs. When I give it to you, dear cousin, I really mean it, that your attention to detail, your ability to dive beneath the surface, to create a moment that suspends people's attention and time, is such a gift that you possess, and you generously give it out to everyone else. That to me is the hallmark of a true artist.
Wow. I mean, first of all, I was going to ask you at the beginning of this, like, what do you've used the word genius, and and every time you say that, for sure that feels good to hear, of course, but I really wanted to know what you meant. Like, what does he mean? What does he mean, genius? What does that mean? And I've heard it from some other people, and I'm not being, you know, gloating or being conceited. I'm the last.
Well, I mean,
I guess to tell you the truth, I'm the last to know. So
it's just a word, you know,
right.
And it's just, you know, appellation. It's something that we put on somebody or something. But what it really means is, when somebody tells you something that you already know,
mm-hmm.
that you know in a deep, secret, hidden way, mm-hmm. and they tell you this, they mention it, whether through art or poetry or dance or song, they mention it again, and they make it come alive
okay.
for you. And when these people do that for you, you love them so much, and they're such a gift because they're drilling at something that is the opposite of, well, it's cold out today, you know, the pedestrian way of looking at life, which is 99.9% of most of our lives. When somebody touches you on a level, it's like a finger of God breaking through this
yeah.
plastic,
yeah.
you know, cellophane coating over everything.
Wow.
And that is, to me, what, you know, and when somebody says you're a genius, or somebody's, you're not always a genius.
Right. Sometimes I was going to say that.
A big fucking dolt.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to even point to any song or instance. What I'm going to tell you is what is really happening is I'm not conscious of myself. I'm completely out of the way for this to happen. I need to let it, and I know it almost sounds cliche, but it is true. I need to let it come through me. Come through me from where? You define that. You know, it's coming from a place that's that's the essence of creation itself, right? So you can define it however you want. But when I step out of the way, I stand a much better chance of creating something truly remarkable or profound.
Yeah, I totally like that idea of, you know, getting out of the way. And I'm always using that caveat too. If people mention something like this to me, like, you know, how does it happen? And I say, look, I hesitate to say this because it does sound cliche, but this idea of something coming through. Now, people have this in different ways, I'm sure. And sometimes it's a sense of love for somebody. A sense of utter cognizance of their reality in your life, which is so special. It could be a spouse, it could be a child, it could be a friend. And that comes along with the sort of the sadness of the realization that nothing is permanent.
Sure, sure.
But nonetheless, there's this thought, this notion of the singular beauty of a relationship, and I'm not even talking about a piece of art. And when that comes through, the world is huge, and the world isn't a place of problems. It's a place of wonder. And it's a rare thing. It's so difficult the way the world is set up, the polarity of things are mostly mundane for us.
Okay, but mostly, Peter, that's beautiful and that's all fine to talk about after the creation has been made. But for me, I'm just speaking personally, like my wife says to me, what is your muse? Like, do you have a muse? Do you have a number of muses? And I said, and I thought about it for a while, and I said, you know, no, I don't sit there and think of a clear pond in nature or a mountain.
No, I totally get
forget
that.
Forget that. I mean, I don't forget think that shit. I don't think of any of that. Okay, you're right.
None of this is a conscious thing. What I think about it is very much akin to, I always think about, you know, a procreative process, and I line it up like this, and this is just an abstract analogy, but you see a young girl jumping into her father's arms at the airport.
Oh yeah.
It takes 0.2 seconds. It's just something that you're seeing on your way to Starbucks.
Oh, that kills
and
me.
That thing is like the initial sort of, you know, moment. The sort of they call it the seminal moment, and for a reason. It's almost like the fertilization of an idea. It has not grown, and it quietly grows. It gestates somewhere while you're, you know, going to the bank, and while you're dealing with your tax account, and while you're driving your kids to school in total mundanity, you're still gestating this idea. Oh. And you're not doing it consciously. You're not meditating on a pond or any of that bullshit.
Right, right.
These ideas are entering into you. If you allow them to, that 2.1 second incidence, of which I use an example of a daughter jumping into her father's arms, which I did see was a soldier returning, was somewhere in Denver.
Sure.
And, you know, I realize even at the time, this thing's going to stick with me. That was a really powerful thing.
Okay, but just for the listeners, like I want to make sure you're being clear. Are you saying that seeing that daughter jump into the father's arms made you immediately take pen to paper and write a song?
No,
way, right?
No, it just was like I was on my way to get a Starbucks. It just was filed away somewhere.
Exactly.
But it wasn't filed away in a way of passivity. It was active, but it was active in a subconscious sense.
It's a massive internal library of feelings and sensations that are there
and
for you.
And those are bubbling and boiling.
Exactly, when you need it.
And now something will happen. It's gestating as a child would gestate. Now some things can make those things come on, if they're hard to say. Mm-hmm. If you've done something really nice for somebody, if you've had an experience, this is what I've found, if you've been now reawakened to wonder somehow.
Right,
it could be a tiny gesture to somebody at a store, like, you know, another alive moment where one pair of alive eyes are looking at another, something like that. I mean, it sounds a little bit sappy, but something that wakes you up to being alive. If you were then to sit down at the piano, there's somehow a likelihood that initial seminal impetus of the girl jumping into her father's arms, it could emerge as something. Does that make any sense?
Not only does it make sense, but this is, I want to tell you how I define that because it's so similar. I call it going into the orchard. Now, you and I both know, because you've been listening to how I have these long lists of things that I have to do every day. That's my default. I'm the kind of guy who every day I wake up and I think, oh yeah, I got to go to So What and have them fix my zipper, sew a button back onto my shirt. And then after I'm done there, I got to go see if I can buy Johnny Pops on a discount at Costco. And then there's this whole list of things. And so that is a way that I kind of put on hold my, what I call going into the orchard to create. For some reason that you would probably be able to explain to me, I am always defaulting to a place where I'm reluctant to go into the orchard. But let me just explain, once I do go into the orchard, maybe it's a job I have to do for advertising. It doesn't matter. There's nothing bad about a job for advertising or
nothing
if I'm
at all. No,
writing a song about my dad or whatever, who, you know, who I lost in October. It's all the same. Whatever it is, what that is like a specific tree. I need the a specific tree to as a destination in the orchard. Now this orchard is an orchard of ideas of unlimited possibility. And if I make a destination for one tree, whatever it is, okay, I got to write a song about so-and-so. It doesn't matter. I go to that tree, I start plucking from the fruit of the tree, and in the first fruit that I pluck, okay, this is the beginning of the creative process, what does that fruit have? It has a ton of seeds in it. Okay, so it's like, it's unlimited. So once I start the process, which for whatever reason I tend to want to avoid. I don't know why that is, but once I do it, I'm hypnotized. I'm in another world, and I can go like 27 hours, which I once did, playing a piano record, getting further and further into the beautiful microscopia of ideas, what you were talking about earlier, exploding the microscopic, miraculous detail, you know?
Yeah, I love the, I never heard, in all the discussions we've had, I never heard the orchard, but it's so great. It reminds me, and I feel 100%, I exactly know what you mean.
Yeah.
Hopefully some of the listeners will know what you mean as well. The idea of, as I said, it's 99% mundane living.
Right.
That's how we do. But knowing that that orchard is there, knowing that there's that experience that you can enter, it's a sanctified area. It's like, to use a religious analogy, the priests in the holy temple in Jerusalem, they only went in there once a year. And they had to go under in terribly, you know, specific circumstances. If they went in there in some ways with the wrong state of mind, they would burn up and die. There's something about
so
going
intense.
Into this
yeah.
rich place, as you call it, the orchard.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's there even when we're in Starbucks or we're going to have our buttons sewed on, as you said. There's still this awareness, this cognizance of there being this place.
Yes, there
but
is.
But we don't want to overuse it. We treat it with utter, utter sanctity because we know that for us, it's the ultimate refuge. It's the ultimate place of joy in our entire lives.
And I love that. And I would, but I would add that the threshold to the orchard, which is open to everyone, needs, well, at least in my case, some little destination, something to get them started.
Okay, let me go into this and
yeah.
using what you brought up, because a lot of people are troubled by this.
Okay.
I always tell people when teaching them or facilitating something, the best way to write, and tell me if you agree with this or not, mm-hmm. is to have a paycheck that's meaningful.
That's what
and
I mean.
A due date.
And right. I guess that's a better way of saying what I was saying, the threshold.
Well, okay, so you'd mentioned the threshold. I'm saying the destination and the due date, which seems to many minds like, well, that sounds so crass and, you know, mercantile and,
right.
you know, but what they don't understand is you're creating a need, a definition, you know, I need it by Tuesday. For example, if somebody says, I'm going to pay you $10,000 to write a song by next Tuesday. And if $10,000 is a significant amount
right.
of money to you, it's saying a lot of things there. It's number one, it's saying, I value your abilities. I value you as a person.
Exactly.
I value the thing about yourself that you feel is most valuable. That's why when people go, they don't like your music and somebody says, well, you know, it's not really you. You shouldn't be so upset. There are obviously people who don't do this stuff because the music is more you than you, the normal you you present to the world. You're talking about the essence of you. So somebody's saying, I want to pay you $10,000 to write a song. They're saying, or whatever number you consider a value. Sometimes it could be free if you think it's a valuable, you know, worthy cause. I value the thing about you that you most value.
Right.
What that does is totally reduce your fear of shame and abandonment and of judgment.
Yep.
So you're already walking towards this orchard. And that I need it by Tuesday says, I need to go to the orchard now. I can't wait till, you know, a couple years from now. That is why the specifics of a due date are so important. And if no one is paying you money and no one is asking for something of a due date, if you want something to appear, you have to do the very difficult work of creating those two things for yourself.
And
one, a motivation, and two, a time structure so that it appears in reality.
That is so important, that last thing you said. I can only tell you from my entire career, and I've created and produced over 55 records for Target's own Lifescapes label, for instance. Now, that output of work was due to nothing other than the proverbial gun to the head or the paycheck. If I had not had those, I would never have done any of this. And is that music me? You better believe it is. And I never phone that music in. It's not wallpaper music. It's not music to go to sleep by, although some may use it for that. I put everything I had into those.
Right. When somebody says, I'm going to pay you and I need it now, mm-hmm. some people that I've discussed this with, maybe some who are less familiar with this creative process, are quick to assume that this is going to be another kind of music. I'll say, for example, this is, you know, admissions in my life. So many things. I had a song called, you know it well, This Too Shall Pass.
Love it.
This Too Will Pass, which is on my record From Strength to Strength.
Right.
I wrote that that song like 15 minutes. Somebody needed it for a Tom Cruise movie.
Oh, now, funny.
I went to the orchard, let's say, really fast because I had a young son. I needed the money. I didn't wind up getting it. I used it for something else. It never was in the Tom Cruise movie.
Right.
But the song was totally real.
Listen to that song. One of the most connective songs you've ever written. I mean,
all right. How about this one? There's a song of mine called Always in Disguise.
Of course, I know.
You might know it. You know, I consider it, you know, among the Peter Himmelman canon. It's a good song in my arsenal, you know?
Right.
It was born out of total, I will tell you the circumstances. You draw whatever conclusion you want from it. Greg Herzenach, a guitarist who's an amazing musician,
right,
was kind of coming into our band in 1991. I was having him join our band, maybe even a little earlier.
Yeah.
And he was in my studio, and he's an amazing guitar player. And I just kind of wanted to show him who the fuck he was dealing with, you know? So I literally wrote the song while he was sitting there. And it was really a song about total male ego, alpha dog bullshit. I mean, the song wasn't about that, but the appearance of the song was born of those seemingly, you know, opposite ideas that are expressed in the song. The hook line of the song is, the most precious things are always in disguise. But, you know, maybe apropos of that idea, that need to have this person understand who he would be playing with was a total ego-driven need. It needed to appear now, hence the analogy of the money and the time. That was my motivation and my time, and it did appear then. It appeared just like that, but it happened to have sent me straight to the orchard. The song itself is a song that I consider very true and in some ways very God. Beautiful and telling.
I didn't know
of
that. So you wrote that thing. So wait, let me go back in time So when you wrote that song, Rock Slow, one of the first Sussman Lawrence songs ever, for Ginny Flannery to come over because she had to audition, remember? You did that. You did with Rob Adelman. You wanted to try out his studio, so you wrote this song called Fuff, which is an unreal, unbelievable song about this guy that survived the Holocaust. So some of your heaviest stuff, you're saying, came from completely, you just manufactured reasons to do it.
Yeah, and I always do. I always think of the songs that I write, not for a mass audience, but for four or five people. You are always one of them. My wife is one of them. Wow. My oldest son, usually, maybe some other of my kids, but Isaac is always in there. And maybe a few other people. It's like for six people, I want them to hear this.
Wait, so are you saying that's okay for people to have ego as one of their... I suppose you really are saying that, because...
I'm saying the 100% truth.
No, but you know, you and I have many times talked about, as artists, we kind of thrive on approval. And if we don't get approval, it's just... Remember, we used to look through the Rolling Stone magazine and think, God, why aren't we in that right now? And like, there's a lot of ego wrapped up.
I mean, it's all about,
stuff.
I mean, it's not, it's about two things. It's a marriage of two things which are seemingly opposite.
Okay.
One is, and I'm just making this up now, so I'll append it later. But, you know, one is ego is saying, I matter. I'm a value. I can do something that matters. I mean, I'm not really great at sports, so it's not going to happen. I'm not going to throw a football really far. I've developed skills in this area. This is my area, unearthing these ideas and showing hopefully some bit of pain or beauty or sorrow in my particular way. This is who I am. So one is about self-worth. It's about ego. And the other thing I'm not even going to say it's a superior thing. It seems a little bit less sort of loud or brash, but one is this idea about exposing wonder for one's own self, delving into the feeling of, as you mentioned, having something pass through you. It's a very religious kind of feeling. It's a spiritual feeling.
Wow.
Whether you're agnostic or not, it's something moving through you that's very uncommon.
You know,
so it's
what?
Deeply pleasurable, and it doesn't involve the approval of others. It's a purely intrinsic,
altruistic
motivator.
Sharing. Yeah, you know what? Can I? You know who I think of when you talk about that? I think of a guy that I always considered one of the most narcissistic people in pop music. You know who I'm thinking of?
Many names come to mind. No.
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but
okay, so don't speak, but should I know or what?
No, I want to praise him, so I'm going to say it. Prince, okay.
Hmm.
When I thought of Prince, it's like he is so self-impressed. He's so full of himself and he's not, what's he, you know, can a person, and I thought, you know, can at the same time, this guy who, to me, appeared so self-involved, couldn't really, trouble himself with anything else than his own immediate needs and his own wonder and his own desires. But then again, on the other hand, what did he share? He shared hours and hours of music that was inspiring to people, comforting to people, and made them feel more alive, made them feel sexier, whatever it is. He actually did the most unselfish thing by being what I call self-involved.
Yeah, look, it's a fusion of the two things.
Right.
And people that create as we do and as Prince did are also susceptible to incredible bouts of self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even self-hatred and a sense of not trusting this because it's so seemingly antithetical to the way the world works. Is this real? Is what I'm dredging up meaningful? Is it valuable? So it's all these currents of opposites. One is this total hyper self-assurance, this total elitist attitude. And then one is this sense of, do I belong? Does anyone love me? Does anyone care about me? What if I didn't have these things? Would they still care about me? Do they care about the depth of me, the essence of me? So it's a fusion of these two things. It's also a fusion of look at me.
Yeah, but
and in Prince's case, it was an issue of look at me, look at me. And one time somebody said, the first time I saw him in concert, he goes, I was so turned off. He goes, do you guys like my ass? I mean, I thought it was hilarious, but like, you know. But on the other hand, what Prince was doing, and I'll tell you like this. There's this religious figure in Los Angeles, this guy, he's this, I won't mention much about him, but I said, you know, did you hear about Prince? I don't know how we got talking. It was Prince. He goes, Prince, what did he do for anyone? He was just a narcissistic little schtunk. I mean,
exactly.
And I got really pissed.
Just in LA, same kind of situation, said to me,
yeah.
Well, now there's a real model for humanity. What did he?
Yeah, okay, so yeah, exactly. Whatever. So I said to him, and I got pretty angry. I was really riled up because Prince had just died. And it still has, for reasons I don't even know, very profound effect on me, as it does for so many people.
Right.
I said, look, here's what you don't fucking know. Prince was listening in a way that you have no idea. As deep a spiritual person as you think you
right
are,
on.
You're a fucking joke next
exactly.
to Prince.
Oh, I know what he said. He said, oh, there's a moral giant of our times.
Yeah, something like that. I said, if you had Prince's ears
exactly.
for a second,
exactly.
you would weep with awe.
He's exotic
what
with
he taught
past-
the world, aside from the music that he gave everyone, which was amazing. But I looked at it like this. A normal person listens at the level of tissue paper. It works. It's perfect. That's all of us. Somebody else might have a nice, expensive Kleenex, a little thicker. An amazing, brilliant person could listen at the level of cardboard. Prince was listening at some level that was thousands of feet thick.
Yeah.
And slowing down and literally act of listening, the act of absorbing the nuances of something, to me,
wow.
was the highest level of teaching that you could possibly have.
I know.
And that's what Prince brought.
Okay, so just tell me, do you agree with this statement that, you know, first of all, it is not necessary to, not everyone has to work in a soup kitchen to give lovingly to humanity. In fact, like Prince, you can simply indulge to the deepest degree your God-given talent for your own pleasure, I add, and you can still give immensely to humanity. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree. And what this is a thing that we used to have this conversation, me, you, and the band, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
It was around the time that Springsteen's Born in the USA mm-hmm. record came out.
Yep.
And I'm always, you know, the contrarian, but I did believe what I was saying. I said like this, so who does more for the world? Bruce Springsteen on stage, and I don't exactly know what he was saying with Born in the USA. It had these quasi sort of political reverberations or something. I mean, get together, fight injustice. I don't know exactly what it was, but you know, it was moving music at the time, and his ass and muscles were well sculpted. It was an amazing cover,
right?
Album cover. I said, so who does more for the world, Bruce Springsteen at the time, or some totally unknown Vietnamese rice farmer who is such a charitable person in his little village and is such a beautiful husband and father, and instilling these great values of love and support. Mm-hmm. And I was totally with the Vietnamese rice farmer. Not saying that Bruce Springsteen isn't a great guy in his personal life. I'm just saying the comparison was between the musician on stage, whatever we know of that, and this person who is meeting out his humanity in these qualitatively powerful but quantitatively infinitesimally small ways. So value to the world, it's really hard to, it's hard to know. Okay. I will say that I believe that quantity doesn't really tell the story in that case.
Well, that's some pretty mystical stuff, actually. I get it, and I, on some level, I totally, and I agree about the rice farmer, but we can't actually explain how that works scientifically. We can show how many people are moved on a certain level by an artist who of renown. You see?
Okay, I mean, I beg to differ here. If you have six children, and you instill in them incredible values, incredible support, and a sense of duty and responsibility to the world. And they go out into the world, and they have their own children, and they do the same. Now, this is a little aspirational, a little idealistic, but, you know, it could well happen that they're bringing these important values into the world. And it's going two, three, four, five, six, eight generations. If you do the math on some of these things, you're putting tens of thousands of people into the world.
You know
what? This qualitative light that can change the world.
Okay.
That can make the world not in some fake, you know,
I agree,
sort of slogan way, but are actually bringing kindness and light into the world on a very practical level wherever they go, in the store, in their marriages, at schools, helping people. In my mind, this is just me blabbing about, when people say, how do you save the world? You save the world in microcosmic ways. They're qualitatively powerful ways. Quantitatively, it doesn't really, we can't control how quantitatively large our actions are going to be. We can only control the level of quality.
I agree 100%, but can I just point out that what you've just done is shown the flip side of the coin of this conversation? Because you started by saying this quasi-religious guy said to you, you know, Prince, it was a narcissistic, you know, jerk or whatever, and you defended Prince. Did you not defend Prince?
I totally defend Prince. I still defend Prince.
Right.
I'm not saying that you can't have an effect in a quantitative way.
Right.
It's also powerful. I'm saying, you know, in Prince's case, I'm not comparing Prince to anybody else. But when somebody besmirches the memory of Prince, somebody that I, you know, in many ways really look up to,
right,
it just pissed me off. What
right.
can I tell you?
Okay,
I'm not making comparisons between Prince or and a rice farmer or my neighbor or my cousins, you know. I'm just saying, don't fuck with Prince right after he died. It makes you look like an idiot.
Right. You know what? By the way, after having said all this, I'm going with the rice farmer every time, just to state my you know, position. But I was merely trying to point out that someone who appears to be so you know, self-absorbed can actually be contributing a lot to humanity. That's all I'm saying.
I totally agree. Yeah. No disagreement. I love that. The idea that people are digging into their wellsprings of their own creativity and showing people that it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
My mind, and this, you know, I don't think it's theoretical. When I think about creativity, I'm not thinking about people winding out on a guitar like Yngwie Malmsteen or like having to, you know, draw realistic portraits. It's digging into, as you just said in the beginning of the thing, of their own aliveness and whatever it is that they're going to bring to the world, that they stop mulling about it and actually start doing it. Once you're engaged in the process of whatever it is, cooking, making love, playing with children, teaching somebody something, you are then evincing pure creativity.
Yep.
And we always mix it up with mastery.
Wow. And mastery is important, right? Because, you know, like Michael Jordan admitted that he never would have gotten to where he ended up.
Yeah, of course. I mean, mastery is the deepening of one's engagement. It's almost evidence, mm-hmm. really, what it is. And I like to think of it as somehow secondary. Wow. First is the will. First is the impetus. First is the engagement, the vision of how things could be.
Yep.
Secondarily is the mastery that you naturally acquire, that you the skills you naturally accrue in trying to deepen that engagement.
Wow. You know, I just want to tell you, as I'm listening to you, like, I just need to tell you that had it not been for you being at 9 years old, sort of the mischievous little catalyst that you were to prompt me on to do all kinds of, you know, fun social experiments and just creative experiments, I don't know exactly if I would have, where it would have taken me if I had not had you, because so I don't know.
I would add to that. It's an important point, not placing my importance in there.
I just
the idea
did.
Of having someone in your life,
right.
to bounce ideas off. And certainly I could make the same claim that without you,
wow.
and prompting me on and inspiring me, mm-hmm. and giving me encouragement,
mm-hmm.
I would never have made any of the stuff that I've made.
That's so.
You are a very valuable person in my life. And I'm not using this podcast have this, you know, weepy testimonial. But I will say, to universalize it, nobody that's ever achieved anything has not had at least one person in their life that just wanted to hear what they had to say. Like my uncle Sonny is, I'm going to interview him too.
Yeah.
My uncle Sonny, Arthur Himmelman, for those of you who don't mm-hmm. know him, he's my uncle. And he was the cool uncle that I used to smoke pot with.
Yeah.
But he was always there wanting to hear what I had to say. And when I started making music, wanting to hear what I had to play. Mm-hmm. And he's there today the same way. I would guarantee you that without him as well as you and a handful of others, because it's not a million people, it comes down to two or three or four.
You told me, you said, listen, you just got to have a community. If a small community, fine, but you have to have one. And
everyone needs a community. And one of the reasons that people don't find themselves, quote, creative, or they're at a place that's seems very fallow in terms of their own creativity, you'll look, I would say it's 100% of the time, they don't have someone in their life that either they trust or that can act as a sounding board, or somebody who's just simply desirous of knowing.
You know, I'll never forget, there was an article in Rolling Stone, I think it was, with Paul Westerberg talking about the replacements, and they asked him, so at the end of the article they said, Paul, what do you suggest to young bands just starting out or people want to get into music? He said, the most important thing for a band's success is that the guys are friends, they like each other, and they laugh a lot together.
So, you know, I don't want to get into like bullshit data and stuff, but I just reading this article in the New Yorker, I'm always reading this kind of stuff. You know, groups that argue and fight, you know, and they bounce back and forth ideas and it's very sloppy, are way better teams than there's one lead person at the front and everything's very organized and not everyone has a chance to speak and everything stays on track and they go home at the same time. We in Sussman Lawrence used to fight like shit about stuff.
We had that room right behind the practice space.
I mean, we would get in all these arguments, but I will say that the love that we had for one another, and even though the band has been dissolved for 30 years, I dare say we still have for one another, is what made us successful then, and it continues to make us successful. To universalize this thing, you can see how close and simpatico Jeff and I are. I mean, fostering those kinds of relationships as a young person is the, and as, you know, echoing Paul Westerberg and probably thousands of others, and he seized on the really the core of the idea. He got the right idea. He didn't say, you know, learn certain chord progressions or, you know, email successful producers. He said, basically, get people around you that can breathe your idea into life. And those people are the most valuable people in your life. And you should make sure that you become one of those people every day for the people around you. First of all, the people closest to you, your family, your children, your spouses, your parents, your siblings. And then you branch it out to other people. And you should be, if you're at our age, we're, you know, 56, you should be mentoring a lot of young people at all times. You know, that's what needs to happen. So that pretty much wraps it up. Jeff, thank you so much. I'm going to put a handsome picture of you with this podcast.
Oh, thank God. Yeah.
And I'll talk to you soon. Thanks for your time on a busy Sunday.
It was my pleasure. Let's do it again soon.
All right. Be well, Zygazoon.
All right, Hamlin. Be well.